Welcome back to another episode of the CSKA Podcast. My name is Jared O'Leary. Each week of this podcast is either an interview with a guest or multiple guests or a solo episode where I unpack some scholarship in relation to computer science education. In this week's episode, I'm unpacking the ACT report, which stands for Action to Catalyze Tech, a paradigm shift for DEI. This report was presented by the Catalyze Tech Working Group and had a variety of different partners working on it. There's no abstract for this report, however, here's the preface. This is from page 2. Quote, the research findings here represent years of work by experts in the field of diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI, and business, and have been extensively peer-reviewed. Experts in the working group met biweekly for a year to aggregate the most relevant evidence-based approaches that businesses can take to radically improve DEI outcomes. If DEI is a journey, the ACT report aims to sit where the rubber hits the road. We know how hard it can be. The good news, there's no need to reinvent the wheel. Instead, we build on findings from dozens of experts and organizations to create a rigorous framework of action. While this report addresses issues specific to the tech industry, it also provides a roadmap for businesses of all kinds. Similarly, although we focus where many large tech companies are headquartered, the United States, our message is global. We recognize that different companies are at very different stages in their journey, and one size never fits all. We also know DEI represents an extraordinary opportunity. This report is a call to action during a transformational moment of business ethics and leadership. In 2020, most tech CEOs and leaders, indeed, most businesses, pledged to improve DEI. But real change requires a paradigm shift, newfound courage to change systems and mindsets. We invite people across the tech sector and beyond to use the tools here to act boldly and collaboratively on the defining issues of our day, equity, end quote. If I were to summarize this report into a single sentence, I'd say that this report provides suggestions for businesses that would like to improve DEI in ways that are relevant to CS organizations and educators. Now, this report is 162 pages long, and so I'm going to try and make this episode as quick as possible to kind of give you a taste or a flavor of what this report has to offer, and then encourage you to read more, you can learn more about it. So although this is targeting businesses and whatnot, this is very applicable, in my opinion, to CS organizations or educators who are interested in improving DEI or just equity in general. So this report is broken down into some different sections. So the first part is the introduction. Then the section one kind of describes the overall approach. Section 2, which is the bulk of this particular report, is on recommendations. Section 3 is on sustaining change, and then it has an appendix. Now, in the recommendations, it's broken down into 4 different main categories. So it uses MOST as an acronym. And so the M stands for Model and Incentivize Inclusive Leadership. The O stands for Operationalize DEI Throughout the Business. The S stands for Share DEI Data, Metrics, and Goals. And the T stands for Transform Pathways into Tech for Underrepresented Talent. Now, on page 6 of the report, they say that they have 3 steps for tech companies or leaders, or in this case, for CS organizations and CS educators and leaders within the space. These steps are to develop a strategy for pursuing or enhancing the 4 different recommendations, then become a signatory to this report by pledging to share data and report progress annually, publicly, and then to support collective action at an industry level, or in this case, as a field level in CS education. And on page 7, the authors suggest that DEI and business cannot be separated in terms of like business strategies needs to incorporate DEI. So for CS educators, one of the things that I've heard many people and organizations argue is that DEI and CS education fundamentally cannot be separated. Now, I've talked about in some other podcast episodes how this might be an alignment for curriculum viewed as social reconstruction as compared to like curriculum as standards or curriculum as social reproduction, etc. I'll include a link in the show notes to a podcast that kind of unpacks that more. But if you're interested in seeing like who is signed on to this, like if we look at page 8 and page 9, there's a bunch of large corporations, whether it's like Apple or Google, Twitter, NAACP, Netflix, etc. So a lot of companies have at least agreed to follow this report. So I'm interested to see even 5 years from now, like what are the annual reports going to look like for each of these companies who have pledged to do this? Now on page 10, this report talks a little bit about DEI and the history of it and why it has failed. So if you're interested in learning more about that, check out page 10. Again, this is 162 pages, so I'm going to try and zoom through this. On page 11, they talk about what could tech companies do. So in this case, what might CS organizations do? So here's a quick summary of some of the highlights on there. So one is to actually use the recommendations in this report. Another is to model and incentivize inclusive leadership. I think CSDA has done a really good job with that, with like the CS Equity Fellows and having conferences where the Equity Fellows are running it and presenting. So kudos to CSDA for that. Another recommendation is to remove bias from hiring systems. This might be out of the control of like individual educators, but it could be something that you can engage in a conversation with somebody who might have more of a say on the hiring. Another is to share DEI data, metrics, and goals. Now, in the elementary school that I was in, and then with the elementary schools we work with at Boot Up, every kid is participating in computer science. But in schools where participation is not required by all students, it would be really interesting to look at data, metrics, and goals related to who participates, and then sharing that with other colleagues and maybe even publicly to learn more about how to improve in those areas. Now, the recommendation is come together as an industry, or in this case, I'd say to come together as a field, create some new pathways for CS educators and role models within the space. And then the last recommendation is they recommend that companies redouble efforts to provide all children with computer science education, which I'm sure many of you hear that and go, hear, hear, I agree. All right, so the next section starting on page 13 is a paradigm shift. So they talk about how we need to change our mindset around DEI, and it talks about the difference between inclusion and belonging and how there has been discussion on including people within a space, but it's also really important to focus on people who feel like they belong within that space, not just included in it. So as an example, I've been to social gatherings with my wife where like she might know the majority of people there and I don't know anyone. And while I am included in that space, I don't really feel like I belong because they're talking about work and stuff that I have no point of connection or context for. That is a very simplified example of inclusion and belonging, which is something that we can consider in our CS classes or organizations. Okay, so if certain demographics of students sign up for our classes or people sign up for our organizations, they might be included, but do they feel like they actually belong there? Maybe? Question mark. And then the next section, starting on page 15, they talk about cradle to career. So this is all about creating a systems thinking approach for DEI. So thinking about DEI from K-12 all the way up through a career. And so the authors argue that corporations and the government and voters really need to proactively support education and educational programs, which I agree. And for CS education, it could start in preschool, like do an Unplugged or Scratch Junior or something. But here's a quote from page 16 that was interesting. It caught my eye. Quote, "If we want to disrupt the school-to-prison pipeline and transform it into a school-to-tech pathway, we must ensure that every student has the fundamental math and science backgrounds to study CS," end quote. The question that I have with that is, well, is that actually what we want? Is the purpose of school to get into tech? I would argue no. Yes, many people will do that, but I don't think we should require it of everybody unless everybody's in fact gonna go into tech. And again, just using the devices does not necessitate needing to understand how to program it. We can't really conflate that. But also, how much math and science do we actually really need to do most CS? I'd argue I use very little science, if any, and only sometimes some math above like maybe some basic addition or subtraction. If I'm like programming the physics of a video game, yeah, I'll use like a lot more math. But if I'm just creating a simple app, I don't really use much math. So I'm like, I agree with the sentiment on this, but there's more nuances to this statement that I think need to be unpacked. I think it's problematic when advocates in any field, like I have experience in CS education and music education, but any field, if you are advocating for something, I'd recommend not speaking in hyperbole, talking about how important it is and it's the most important thing ever, and it's going to be the most important thing ever for everybody. Probably not. I think it can kind of set us back when we start making claims like that, because skeptics or people like myself will listen to it and go, no, you're exaggerating there. But that's just my opinion. Now, one of the interesting things on page 17 is it has a case study. So it talks about Atlanta Public Schools. And these case studies keep appearing throughout. So for like each one of these sections in the paper, it gives some case studies for people to kind of learn from and dive deeper into it. And on page 18, they have a call to action for companies to help support colleges that prepare teachers to teach computer science. That's something that has been like a huge gap. And like organizations like Boot Up, who's a nonprofit that I work for and that powers this podcast, learn more at bootuppd.org, have kind of filled this gap where we have a bunch of educators out in the field that don't know computer science and want to learn it, then we don't have pre-service education programs really focusing on teaching computer science education to future teachers. So this report is calling on companies to help support those initiatives. Like we've received support from like Amazon Future Engineer. Then I know some other universities, colleges have received some report from other organizations and whatnot. All of that can kind of help prepare future and current CS educators. All right, so section one, this starts on page 19. So it talks about the MOST framework that they're using. So again, MOST is model and incentivize inclusive leadership. The O is operationalize DEI throughout the business. The S is share DEI data, metrics, and goals. And the T is to transform pathways into tech for underrepresented talent. They provide 10 important recommendations. Again, this is on page 20. Quote, number one, increase your personal DEI expertise. Number two, establish DEI as a business imperative. Number three, support DEI with funding, metrics, strategies, and accountability. Number four, Redesign systems, including hiring, retention, and promotion systems to remove bias. Number 5, apply both DEI framework and an ethical framework to the design of products and services. Number 6, support industry-wide DEI reporting standards and share anonymized data. Number 7, set public goals. Number 8, advocate for computer science, CS, to be required in all schools. Number 9, build systems capacity to create more CS teachers at all levels and invest in CS faculty within colleges of education. Number 10, invest in organizations that connect talent from underrepresented groups to tech careers, end quote. That gives you a very high-level overview of the recommendations that they provide in this particular report. Again, it's 162 pages, so I'm going to go over these very quickly. But hopefully this podcast will help highlight some sections that will be of interest to you or the organizations that you work with. Now, you'll notice a couple of times in here it mentions systems thinking. So on page 22, they talk more about, well, what does this mean? So they said that this is a chronic problem. This is not a one-off thing. It's familiar and is known in history. We've tried to solve this problem before, and it is an important issue that needs to be addressed, but we can't just address it through band-aids. We have to approach this by trying to fix the system that is broken. Now on pages 27 and 28, you notice that there is a detailed summary of the recommendations. So it includes each of the 10 different actions, as well as like some sub actions for each one of those. So like sub action 9 has like 4 suggestions on things that you can do. And I'm gonna kind of unpack each of these very quickly in the following recommendations. So in the first recommendation, number 1, model and incentivize inclusive leadership. Now, on page 32, they provide a little table that kind of summarizes, well, what exactly is inclusive leadership? So I'm going to read this off real quick. Quote, visible commitment. Inclusive leaders articulate authentic commitment to diversity, challenge the status quo, hold others accountable, and make diversity and inclusion a personal priority. Humility. Inclusive leaders are modest about capabilities, admit mistakes, and create spaces for others to contribute. Awareness of bias. Inclusive leaders show awareness of personal blind spots as well as flaws in the systems and work hard to ensure a meritocracy. Curiosity about others. Inclusive leaders demonstrate an open mindset and deep curiosity about others. Listen without judgment and seek with empathy to understand those around them. Cultural intelligence. Inclusive leaders are attentive to others' cultures and adapt as required. Effective collaboration. Inclusive leaders empower others, pay attention to diversity of thinking and psychological safety, and focus on team cohesion, end quote. So all of these are really interesting strategies that can be done not only with like a leader of a CS organization, but also just like educators who are CS leaders. So again, the 6 areas are visible commitment, humility, awareness of bias, curiosity about others, cultural intelligence, and effective collaboration. I think all of those are very applicable in CS classrooms. And they do provide a citation if you want to learn more about where this came from. Might actually end up reading that article, maybe turn that into an unpacking scholarship episode in the future. So stay tuned. All right, so the first action to increase your personal DEI expertise. So the first sub action on page 35 talks about how, quote, allyship is not a state, it's an ongoing action. Make time for the personal reflection and engagement that sustains allyship, end quote. So there are 3 main ways that they recommend doing this. One is to audit your personal and professional network. Another is to read, watch, and listen. And then the third one is to trust and rely on experts to elevate your personal learning. Each of these are unpacked in a few sentences. So if you want to learn more about it, I recommend taking a look on page 35. And also on that page, there are some essential skills that they recommend for modeling allyship. And those skills are to, quote, develop an intrinsic motivation for allyship, relearn the ways you see the world, take courageous actions, speak up when you spot inequity, support marginalized group members' efforts and do so on their terms, and embrace discomfort as a catalyst for behavior change, end quote. The next sub-actions are to interact personally and on an ongoing basis with employees from underrepresented groups and employee research groups, which are ERGs. The next sub-action is to model growth mindset. And I actually don't think I've done a podcast episode on growth mindset yet. I know I've mentioned it multiple times, so thinking out loud, I should probably record one because it keeps coming up. But until then, if you're interested in it, check out Carol Dweck, D-W-E-C-K. I'll include a link in the show notes so you can learn more about growth mindset. But honestly, if you just search for it, you'll find a ton of articles, blogs, research, etc. All right, the next sub-action for this one is to disrupt everyday biases that subtly but repeatedly harm people from underrepresented groups. They also recommend giving personal signals that you're an inclusive leader. And again, for each one of these sub-actions, there are sometimes a couple of sentences or paragraphs kind of unpacking, okay, well, how would I give signals that I'm an inclusive leader? Well, there's 4 recommendations in there on how to do that. If you want to check that out, the link in the show notes at jaredoleary.com will take you directly to this report. All right, so action 2 is to establish DEI as a business imperative. Or in this case, we might say as an organization imperative or classroom environment imperative, etc. So the first sub-action for this on how to actually do it is to, quote, include DEI as a core company value and annual priority. Ensure each C-suite leader's business plan has DEI objectives on representation, culture, and where applicable, product. End quote from page 41. They provide six examples of how you can do that. The next sub-action is on elevating the role of the chief diversity officer to ensure that they have adequate authority, training, and resources to influence the C-suite. They have six recommendations for that as well. The next sub-action they recommend is to apply the same risk tolerance to DEI as product innovation. One example that I heard, this is a paraphrasing from a discussion at the Worldwide Developers Conference that I went to a few years ago. Forget when that was. This was for Apple. So they're talking about how when you design for the median or the mode or just like the group average, you exclude the margins. But when you design for the margins, you include everybody. So when creating products, whether it's a lesson plan or a curriculum or like a robot you're selling, if DEI is a core component of your product research, it can make it more inclusive. Hence the I in DEI, or even more accessible, DEIA, is becoming a more popular term than just DEI, at least in some of the circles that I've seen. Now, in each one of these like actions and whatnot, they include some case studies, or in this case, like here's some examples of how you can set representation goals. Or, well, what was affirmative action and how has it had a positive influence? Again, I'm only like a quarter of the way through this paper and I'm on page 45 right now. So there's a lot more to unpack, a lot more resources that they point toward. Just kind of skimming the surface on this one, not really doing a deep dive because this would end up being a few hour long podcast. So a little bit different format than previous episodes that were unpacking a specific paper that was shorter. Like last week's episode was like a 4-page paper. But the next sub-action for this particular area is to devote part of one board meeting and ideally part of one quarterly earnings call to DEI challenges and progress. So one way we might be able to reframe that is to devote one entire PLC and like quarterly goals or reflections or even semesterly, like however you end up doing it in your school, to focus on DEI, the challenges, progress, etc. Another sub-action is to prioritize DEI in your company's spending strategy through intentional partner, vendor, and supplier diversity policies. That's a really interesting area that I've only kind of like skim the surface on exploring. But there's so many interesting things to consider with that, at least at the nonprofit level. I'm not sure how that would relate to being in the classroom. Like there's like the approved vendors list and whatnot. So you're kind of limited on who you can reach out to, but it could be at least worth starting a conversation in your district. Like, well, who is on the approved vendors list and why? Who's excluded and why? How does that relate to DEI goals, etc.? All right, so recommendation two is on operationalizing DEI throughout the business or organization in this case, maybe. Well, maybe you're a business. I don't know. Can't speak for you. Here's a really interesting quote from page 50, called the litmus test. Quote, if you want to know if your DEI strategy has truly been operationalized at your company, ask any middle manager to tell you the actions they take on a regular basis. And in the last 3 months, to implement your company's DEI strategy. If they have no significant actions or outcomes to report, this tells you that your DEI strategy isn't being operationalized, end quote. That's a really good thing to consider. This could be like, ask your principal, or ask a teacher, or ask the CS mentor, or ask a leader in your, I don't know, local CSTA chapter, which you can learn more about in the podcast with Jason Bohr. I'll include a link to that episode. It's a good interview. I'm really curious if we were to ask that at like boot up, what people would say. I'm also curious, like the former district that I worked in, where I was the mentor CS educator, who'd run like our PDs and whatnot, what would they say the goals were? All right, the next action is on supporting DEI with funding, metrics, strategies, and accountability. Here's an important quote from page 52. Quote, to measure progress on equity and inclusion, however, companies need to track more than representation. Without tracking inputs into critical processes affecting equity and inclusion, such as employee development and performance evaluation, it is difficult to change culture. Companies should, for example, keep track of patterns in task assignment and role distribution and analyze formal feedback to ensure consistency in length and quality, end quote. Okay, so how do we do that? First sub-action is to create DEI data infrastructure to equip teams and leaders with data to make informed decisions, define strategy, and track progress. The next sub-action is to set internal goals and track implementation of strategic actions. They indicate that best practices require goal setting at entry level, mid-career, and leadership levels. And the next sub-action is to create incentives for C-suite leaders, managers, and others to achieve DEI goals. The following sub-action is to direct a pay audit for underrepresented groups, starting with gender and race, to close the gaps. That'd be really interesting to look at. I wonder, thinking out loud here, if there are gender and pay gaps in teacher salaries and whatnot. I asked because the ladder system, like there wasn't really much budging or negotiating that could be done, at least in the districts that I was in. It was basically, how long have you been teaching? and how many degrees do you have, or how many credit hours rather. And that would kind of determine how much you would make. And one of the interesting things that they note in here is you need to identify and assess the factors other than just race and gender that might actually impact the differences in pay. So I'd recommend taking a look at this section, as well as every one of these sections, honestly, that stand out to you, because there's some interesting little tidbits in here. But again, it's 162 pages, so I don't want to make this like a 4-hour episode. And by the way, if you notice my voice sounds different, the timbre or whatever, it's because this is a second day of recording. All right, so action number 4 is redesign systems, including hiring, retention, and promotion systems to remove bias. Here's a quote from page 58. Quote, despite inclusive values held by many people in companies, organizational processes, systems, and structures often contain unconscious and unintentional bias. Those issues must be identified and systems should be redesigned. The point is not to fix people from underrepresented groups by encouraging them to behave more like people from majority groups, but to fix the bias system itself. Startups can build in best practices, introduce training, and create inclusive systems right from the beginning, end quote. All right, so how do we do it? So one of these sub-actions is to invest in middle managers' success, train them to be inclusive leaders, then hold them accountable for meeting DEI goals. I'd argue if you replace like middle managers with like mentor teacher or chapter leader, etc., the suggestions that follow would really help in terms of having training to kind of recognize and disrupt the biases that a person might have. Now, one of the interesting tidbits that they give is they mention that if you rely too much on referrals from current employees or people within like the leader's social circles or network, this can actually reinforce exclusionary practices. So looking beyond just who do you know in your networks, because that might result in similar people, similar perspectives, which is good in some ways, but it doesn't challenge the status quo and other ways. The next sub-action, this is on page 61, is to design recruiting and interview systems to drive out bias. So one way you can do that is to focus on diversity over how fast you hire people. You could focus on skills, not just on degrees. You could revise the job descriptions. You can adjust the interview questions and develop skills in interviewing. You could build in some different systems and procedures to kind of check your own biases. Then on page 64, there's an interesting rule called the Mansfield Rule, which if you want to learn more about it, is talking about how underrepresented groups should make up 30% of a pool to actually disrupt bias. So you can't just hire one person unless maybe you're a group of three who's from an underrepresented group. One of the questions that I have when I was looking at this is, okay, but what groups are we talking about in terms of underrepresentation? And are we looking at intersectionality, etc.? But I'll talk about this a little bit more at the end when I share some lingering questions and thoughts. All right, so the next subsection or sub-action is to design talent development, feedback, and promotion systems to minimize bias and reward inclusion. I'm not sure what that would look like in a school setting. I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm just saying I haven't been on the HR side of schools because it's usually like a very cut and dry in terms of here's the PDF that has the pay scale. Every year you'll get a little bit of a boost. Or every couple of years, depending on what district you're in. And if you get more credit hours and more degrees, you get another boost. You either move down or you move to the right. So if anyone has some ideas on how schools might do that, that'd be an interesting conversation to have. So feel free to hit me up on the contact me button on my website, jaredleary.com. Happy to chat. Although it's going to have to be likely sometime in December or January, as I haven't been able to do interviews lately because of all the construction work and whatnot, moving locations, all the joys that come with that. All right, subaction 4.4 is to reduce bias in task assignment and work allocation and introduce a process to spread stretch assignments beyond favored groups. So there's a couple of pages of some interesting content on here, but I want to highlight or read off rather something from page 72. So this is NC WIT's task assignment toolkit. So it's got 4 questions and then some tips. So this is from page 72. Quote, number 1, are some team members assigned more frequently to highly visible tasks or projects? Number 2, are other talented team members missing out on these assignments, perhaps because they are quieter or because their potential has been overlooked? Number 3, are some team members more frequently assigned to high-risk projects? Why or why not? Examine criteria used for assigning tasks. Number 4, make explicit your criteria for assigning tasks for each project and ensure they are relevant to these projects. For example, supervisors sometimes avoid assigning important projects to team members who work flexible hours, even if that schedule should not impair their ability to do the job. Top tips. Watch for patterns where team members perform stereotypically gendered roles. Research illustrates that women more frequently take notes or take on office work, e.g. organizing logistics, social events, etc. Avoid or interrupt comments like women are more social or men are better problem solvers. These comments reflect a misunderstanding of gender difference research and exaggerate its findings. Avoid the glass cliff phenomenon of giving projects that are more likely to fail to employees from underrepresented groups, end quote. So some interesting things to think of, whether you're a classroom teacher, working in a PLC, or working in a CS organization. So again, lots of interesting little tips and things to consider. in this report, which I hope you consider reading. All right, so sub-action 4.5 is to improve sponsorship, allyship, and mentorship opportunities and ensure the opportunities you personally provide are balanced among different communities. So here's a quote from page 72 that kind of talks about, well, what's the difference between mentorship and sponsorship? Quote, mentors advise while sponsors use their social capital to actively cultivate opportunities for sponsorees. Senior leaders can serve as role models, open doors to new opportunities, offer support during setbacks, and provide honest feedback. End quote. So that was an interesting distinction that I hadn't heard of. I guess what I try and do is sponsor, and I hadn't heard of it referred to that way. Like whether I'm collaborating with like a colleague at work or just in the field or in like the dissertation that I'm supervising right now, I'm actively trying to find opportunities for the people that I collaborate with to help them achieve the goals that they want or branch out into new areas that they might be hesitant to do. Like, hey, I want to publish, but I've never done it before. All right, cool. Let's co-author something. So it's a good point to not just advise, but to also like seek out opportunities and kind of distribute things or lift up voices, etc. And the part about like the social capital, like if you listen to the interview that I did with Kimberly Scott, we talk about this a little bit more, as well as like the article that I unpack on Bourdieu applied to CS education. Your social capital is extremely valuable, especially if you are a leader in whatever capacity that may be. So the more that you can lift up people who have less social capital in that particular context, the better. So leverage it to their advantage to be able to help them out in ways that maybe you wish you had when you were gaining your own social capital in whatever context. All right, so the next sub-action is 4.6. It says to use ERGs to support employee development, create community, and contribute to business objectives, not as a substitute for a DEI strategy. And an ERG is an employee resource group. There are some suggestions on how you might do that on page 73. But the next sub-action, 4.7, is to evaluate what works and what does not, and iterate accordingly. That can be done with so much, whether it was like after a lesson, I'll go back and watch recordings of the lesson, and then go, what worked well, what didn't work well, what were the kids doing that I wasn't paying attention to? Who spoke the most? Who did I talk to the most? Who spoke the least? Who was least engaged? Why? Etc. But then you can also look at this in terms of projects. All right, we just finished a new curricular unit, writing it out or something. What worked really well? How can we improve it? Or even just like little minor stuff. Like on the weekend, I was video editing for all the gaming and drumming stuff because I'm a nerd and create content in leisure and for work. And I realized that I could adjust some of the key mappings in a way that would save me roughly 7 seconds every time I was bouncing a video. And considering I share 7 videos a day on YouTube, or at least have been in the last couple of months, that adds up over time, especially because there's the widescreen version, there's the TikTok and Shorts version, there's the Instagram version. So each one of those 7 videos has 3 different variations of it for different formatting, dimensions, etc. So even though 7 seconds sounds like, okay, Jared, whoop-de-doo, it really adds up. But that is a very simple example in relation to technology. We can also look at, okay, well, what is working well in an organization in terms of how are we communicating or not communicating? What could we improve? And if people are actually open to sharing their thoughts, then you can actually iterate and improve, or not, which stinks. Now on page 75 and 76, there are some recommendations for focusing on disabilities. I'll include links in the podcast to some of the previous episodes that I did on disabilities in relation to CS education. There's some really interesting interviews with like Maya Israel, Jesse Rathgeber, as well as some unpacking scholarship episodes. Disability is one of those things where when we say CS for all, it doesn't always mean people with disabilities. So it's really something we need to consider and honestly improve, which again is one of the reasons why instead of just going in DEI, some people are referring to it as DEIA for accessibility. So check out the show notes for some more information on that. But let's get into action 5, which is to apply both a DEI framework and an ethical framework to the design of products and services. Now, when you think of a product or a service, that could be like a curricular unit or a lesson or a robot that you sell as an organization, or maybe just your own teaching or facilitating. So again, this is like geared towards corporations, but if we think beyond that, use this as a springboard for ideas, we can apply this in a classroom context or organizational context. All right, so how do we do this? So sub-action 5.1 is to develop product inclusion principles and operationalize them throughout the product development process. Here's a quote from page 79, quote, address the user. Consider race, gender, age, education level, ability, geographic location, and other dimensions of diversity when developing a product. Start with equity. Inclusion shouldn't be an afterthought. Make sure that underrepresented voices are being heard throughout the product development process. Continually test. To ensure products are inclusive, keep researching and testing, end quote. All right, so here's an example. So there's a grant that I've been working on for a couple of years, and my main role in this grant was to create curricular units. It was in the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming, which has the Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone tribes living within the same shared space as a community. When creating these curricular units, They were supposed to integrate computer science with new social studies standards in Wyoming. And then we eventually were like, oh, this actually works really well with ELA standards as well. So while doing that, my role was to try and focus on the culturally responsive side of things. Make it so that students were able to express themselves. Being an outsider, somebody who is white, who is not native, and who lives in a completely different state, I wanted to make sure that I was not trying to impose my own ways of being or understanding on the students in the reservation. So the way that we addressed the user, like this first column that is discussed in 79, is we made it so that all the lessons are about students being able to learn about their own understandings of their culture by diving deeper through mentorship with elders and community members, and to share what they have learned, or to share their own understandings and interests on what they believe to be culture. It might relate to being Northern Arapaho or Eastern Shoshone, or it might relate to being an artist or a gamer or whatever. The entire design of the curricular unit focused on equity, making it so that we explored from the history of the Wind River Reservation, like some of the problematic things the United States government did. And we focused on highlighting underrepresented voices from within the community and outside of the community. And then we just continually iterated on things. So we constantly got feedback. We constantly were seeking like artwork from students within the community and incorporating that into the projects, making it so that peers could remix each other's artwork with attribution, of course, and constantly checking back with, is there any information in these resources that might be considered culturally sacred? If so, we need to remove them. So that is one example of how you might be able to focus on inclusion principles throughout a like lesson plan process or curricular unit development, etc. So I kind of did a little bit of a deeper dive there just to kind of demonstrate how you might use some of these ideas in case you're like, okay, well, I don't create a product. I just teach a class. Right. But let's think about it in relation to creating a lesson. Think of that as your product. And the service is teaching or facilitating that lesson. Let's get into the next sub action. It's 5.2. Prioritize accessibility in your products. Page 82 has some principles for accessible web content, which talks about making a website perceivable, operable, understandable, and robust. I'd recommend checking out page 82 for those examples, especially if you run like a JavaScript, HTML, CSS course. But subaction 5.3 is to address potential bias in your artifact intelligence, AI, and machine learning, ML, technology. So if you are doing any kind of AI or machine learning, I'd recommend taking a look at page 83 and 84. But 5.4 is to consider how your company can mitigate harm from the application of your technology. And if you're listening to that and going, okay, well, I don't create technology, like, how's this going to cause harm? Just a scratch project, okay? Let's say you engage in a project that only represents gender as a binary or presents a heteronormative view, meaning all the relationships in the Scratch project are heterosexual people, or only presents one skin tone, etc. All of these can cause harm in different ways. It may serve as an unintended, hopefully, microaggression. This is why I like curriculum development, in my opinion, is really difficult. You really got to think through so many little nuances like that and more, and not just write a lesson. You need to think about how's it going to impact individuals in different groups, different identities, different cultures. That's one of the reasons why I think teachers should be paid more, among many other reasons. It's hard work to consider all of that. And it's one of the reasons why I prefer project-based learning, among many other reasons. Project-based learning allows you to actually customize things rather than just like, okay, we're going to engage in a puzzle-based platform that students, teachers can't adjust. Whatever characters are in that game are what's in that game or that platform or whatever. But if it's project-based and it's more interest-driven, okay, well, if there are biases built into a project, we can encourage kids to remix the project and make it not so biased, etc. All right, so 5.5 subaction is to increase representation and disrupt stereotypes in your original content, marketing, and advertising. So again, kind of building off of what I mentioned previously, if you think of your advertising or your marketing, think of like what is displayed in your room or on your website or in the curricular resources that you're sharing. Like I did an Unpacking Scholarship episode that was talking about how in order to try and eliminate some biases, some curricular developers would use objects or architecture rather than people or animals to try and disrupt some of the stereotypes that might be present in some of the imagery used. In your classroom, think about who is displayed on your walls, what kind of identities, cultures, ontologies are represented. So on page 87, they have recommendations for focusing on who is being featured in an ad, who is framing the narrative, and the depth and agency of that character. Are they a caricature, or is there more nuances to them? So on that last note, as a more recent example, my wife introduced me to someone who knew that I was non-binary, but they had no idea what I looked like, they didn't know my name, They just knew that my wife was married to somebody who was non-binary. And when the person met me, they were like taken aback by like, wait, your racist partner? And while they meant no harm by it, they clearly had this like caricature of like, oh, well, a non-binary person is somebody with like blue hair and like facial piercings and yada yada. I say that not as a critique of that person, because I have these like caricatures built up or stereotypes built up of groups of people that I don't normally interact with. So we need to make sure that when we are representing people, we are not representing surface level caricatures and saying this person represents everybody who is within this particular culture or identity. So if you want to see some of the questions that they have on page 87 or things to think through, I highly recommend checking that out. All right, so recommendation 3 is to share DEI data, metrics, and goals. So action number 6 under this one is to support industry-wide DEI reporting standards and share anonymized data. I'd argue we could also do this within the CS field, which KPOR Center has done, and I did a podcast on like, here's the state of CS educators across the nation. So I'll include a link to that in the show notes. Highly recommend taking a look at that or listening to that episode. But how do we do this? At least in this report. Okay, so 6.1 subaction is at minimum commit to collecting, tracking, and publishing intersectional data on representation, hiring, and attrition. Now, keyword in there is intersectional data, not just here are data on gender within our classes or in our organization. And then in a different table, here are data on race in our classroom, district, organization, etc. But looking at, okay, yeah, that's great. But what about the intersections between race and gender? How does that break down? So on page 96, there's an interesting histogram at the bottom that I highly recommend taking a look at. So it shows that men earn more than women in general. But if you look at the intersections of gender with race or ethnicity, Hispanic men make about $36,000, while Asian men make about $66,000. So again, check out page 96 if you want to see a very clear example of why intersectional data is important to take a look at. But subaction 6.2 is to disaggregate baseline metrics by function and level and align on definitions to ensure apples to apples comparison. So this is taking a look at, well, what is the function or role of individuals, and then what is their level? Are they a director? Are they a manager? Are they mid or entry level? Are they an intern, etc.? So I guess in a school context, it might be, are they like a teacher's aide? Are they a teacher? Are they the superintendent? Are they an assistant principal? Are they an HR director, etc.? So look at roles and functions within an organization or within your district to see, how do we represent the students that we're actually working with, or do we not, and in what ways? Subaction 6.3 is to expand demographics beyond equal employment opportunity commission categories, including intersectional data through self-ID surveys. Now, if you look at page 99, there's an example of race and ethnicity categories that shows much more expansive than what I've seen on like recent forms that I've filled out, or like medical stuff or whatever. So for example, some of the race or ethnicity categories are African-American or Black, East Asian, Hispanic or Latinx, Middle Eastern, Native American, Alaskan Native, First Nations, Pacific Islander, South Asian, Southeast Asian, White, prefer not to answer. And then in this section, they talk about how it's important to make sure that people have the opportunity to select multiple categories, which is an excellent point. Some of the ones that I filled out did not have that option. So mixed race individuals had to select one. All right, subaction 6.4 is to leverage surveys to measure inclusion and employee sentiment. How do people feel included? Or going back to something that I mentioned earlier, how do people feel in terms of their sense of belonging and then their sentiment about working at the organization or in the district? 6.5 is to share anonymized DEI data with an industry body that will support standardization of DEI data collection. Okay, so this is really interesting, and I'm glad to see that they're encouraging tech companies to do this, but this would be interesting to look at for like the KPOR Center's report that I mentioned not too long ago. In what ways might we share data about like CS educators with the KPOR Center? If you get their survey in the future, maybe set aside some time to fill it out if you didn't previously, or sign up for their newsletter, etc. These are some different ways that we can kind of model what is being encouraged by the industry within the field of CS education. The more data we have, the more we can actually address some issues. But to argue with myself there, it has been known for a very long time that like 86% roughly of like elementary teachers are white women, and that hasn't really changed too much. So once we have the data and we like report on, okay, well, there's clearly some demographic imbalances going on here, maybe we should take a look at how to diversify things. And one way we might do that is with goals. Speaking of, action number 7 is to set public goals. How's that for a transition? All right, so how do we do it? So 7.1, subaction, is to analyze your company's DEI data to identify discrepancies and gaps. Again, when I just mentioned, it's been well known that there's the vast majority of teachers are white women in the elementary space in particular. So subaction 7.2 is to select meaningful benchmarks to determine whether goals are realistic on any given metric. So now that we know that 86% roughly of teachers across the nation are white women. And by nation, I mean United States. My apologies for everyone else in the rest of the world. I know the world does not revolve around the United States. I just also happen to know most of the people who listen are from the United States. Shout out to everyone who's not and everyone that is. Now, one of the interesting things that they mentioned in this short section is to not only have external benchmarks, but also internal benchmarks. And if you're like, wait, what are those? Take a look at page 104. How's that for a teaser? 7.3 is to ensure goals are challenging to motivate meaningful progress. So I've done a lot of reviews of goals, whether it's for like multi-million dollar Department of Education grants, like being a grant reviewer for those, as well as like something a lot less high stakes, like setting goals within like the music education department in a former district that I was in. And oftentimes, whether I'm reviewing a grant or engaging in those PLCs, we'd hear goals like, okay, well, we're at a like 64% passing rate on this particular thing. We're going to try and get to 65 by the end of the year. Like, okay, I mean, that might not statistically be a good enough change to really strive for, or is that really motivating meaningful progress? So 7.3, I definitely agree with that intent behind it. Set goals, yes, but make sure it's not just like, I'm going to get 1 point better. And I say that as somebody who is like constantly trying to find that 1% way to improve things, like I was mentioning saving 7 seconds for each video that I bounce. I'm that kind of person. But to say like, we're going to improve our percent of underrepresented groups by 1% or something like that. I don't know about that. Maybe aim for something a little bit loftier, like 1.5%. I'm just kidding, that was a joke. 7.4 for the subaction is to ensure that goals are SMART goals, which are specific, measurable, attainable, or achievable, realistic, and time-bound. And there's a ton of resources on SMART goals. Just search for a SMART goal, and then you can learn more about it. 7.5 is to incentivize goal attainment. So that's an interesting idea. Not sure how you would do that in a district, depending on what your goal is. Because like when I think of like a corporate space, like an incentive might be, if you meet this goal, we'll give you a bonus. Great. But that doesn't really happen often in teaching. Although I guess to argue with myself, we do have like the pay for performance, which where I was in the districts, because I saw every kid like K-6 in my first district and then every kid K-8. Like I was either tied to a specific grade level, like depending on how the fourth graders test, that's going to determine your performance pay. Okay, great. I guess I'll really be on my A game with the fourth grade music classes. But then others would do like an aggregate where it was like, okay, across the whole school, here's what your performance pay is. And that didn't motivate me at all. Because quite frankly, I don't care how kids are doing on test scores. I care whether or not they actually enjoy learning and want to continue to do that, as opposed to if they like increase their reading scores by 1%. Great, but do they hate reading now as a result of it? Maybe. All right, let's get into recommendation 4, which is to transform pathways into tech for underrepresented talent. I would argue that this section we could think of, how do we transform pathways into education, or specifically CS education for underrepresented talent? Which, I don't like that word talent. I did a content analysis on the use of the word over the course of, I think it was like 5 or 6 decades. And it's so vague. Like some people view it as like this innate thing that you're born with that can't change, fixed and immutable. And then other people look at talent as, nah, like you just gotta practice. So I don't know. I would avoid that word if I were writing this, but I'm not. I'm just talking about it. Other people did the hard work. I'm doing the easy part. So in this, they're talking about how tech companies should do certain things, but I'm gonna modify this slightly to say, okay, well, to diversify the CS educators in the country, perhaps we should recruit from universities that have diverse student populations. And we can do that by requesting DEI data from these universities or develop relationships with different workforce programs that help prepare future teachers. But I say this with the understanding that at this point, districts are just happy to get anyone in the room with teacher shortages and all that stuff that's been going on lately. So this is like an ideal. But honestly, I don't know if we have the capacity to really focus on that right now. Depends on where you're at. Some districts are doing great and they're able to focus on this. Others are not. And so they're focusing on just getting anybody in the room, regardless of their identities or cultures. And I understand that DEI should be a part of every process. I also understand like an administrator perspective or even a student and parent perspective where it's like, Yeah, but there's nobody able to teach this class. Let's just find somebody, anybody who can do that, regardless of whether or not they improve diversity within the district. But that might be a hot take. So know that I mean it with best intentions and understand that there are many nuances here. Totally on board with DEI being throughout everything, but also understanding that there are other things to consider as well. Not as an either or, but as an and. Yes, we need to improve diversity and we need to make sure that somebody's in the classroom. All right, so action 8 is to advocate for computer science to be required in all schools. So for the first sub-action that they recommend, 8.1 is to partner with the Expanding Computer Education Pathways, ESEP, Alliance to initiate and support state and district-based policy reform to improve CS education. If you haven't checked out ESEP, I will include a link to it in the show notes. If you type in ESEP computer science, I'm sure you'll find it within the first page of search results on Alta Vista. I'm just kidding, I don't even know if that exists anymore. 8.2 recommends encouraging increased local, state and federal investment in educational equity, CS educational policies, and well-prepared teachers. Wholeheartedly agreed there. I'm assuming the audience does as well if you're listening to this particular episode, or I guess this podcast in general. So I'm going to skim by these. 8.3 is to leverage site selection for business expansion to drive investment in K-12 CS funding. This I'm very skeptical of. I've co-authored an article that kind of critiques corporate influence on education. So if you want to get really nerdy, take a look at it. It's written for music educators, but I promise there's a ton of computer science in there. Builds off my work in my dissertation. And again, it's pretty nerdy. All right, so skipping on to action number 9, this is to build systems capacity to create more CS teachers at all levels and invest in CS faculty within colleges of education. This is an interesting one. So, Up, the nonprofit that I work for, has focused on in-service educators, helping prepare people who don't have a background in CS be able to teach CS. But I see a lot of open job postings for colleges and universities to be able to help prepare not only in-service, like at the graduate level, but pre-service educators to become CS educators. And this is great. I do see that as potentially making it so Boot Up does not need to exist in the way that it currently does. And I say that as like a good thing. Like the goal is to make it so that Boot Up is irrelevant at some point because we've achieved our mission. And at that point, maybe pivot to focus on other things. And I see the university and CS education side of things happening at the collegiate level or pre-service as being a way to help with that. But unlike the field that I've actually got all my degrees in music education, the people who become music educators typically make more than they would as a performing musician alone. The opposite is the case for CS educators. So while there might be an overabundance at times of music educators in different locations, all vying for the same high school job or whatever, for CS education, you could double, triple, quadruple your pay by going into industry. So I honestly see this as being as a recurring issue where people who get degrees in relation to computer science are going to look at the field of computer science education and go, I don't know if I want to deal with all of those issues, whether it's helicopter parents or school shootings or low pay or whatever. So let's take a look at what the recommendations are for this. So 9.1 is to create CS education capacity in the schools that prepare teachers. Totally agree with that. 9.2 is to advocate for and support teacher certification in colleges of education. I have a very mixed reaction to certification programs. I've mentioned this before. I am not considered highly qualified as an elementary educator because I never took a 100 level course on phonics. Doesn't matter that I have a PhD, I've presented over 100 times, have a dozen publications, received multiple international teaching awards. I'm not highly qualified, at least in Arizona. I ranted about that in other podcasts, so I'll leave it there and say, I understand, but also there's some problems with the certification system. 9.3 for the sub-action is to prepare existing teachers to teach CS. Here's a quote from page 117. Quote, corporations can pair CS professionals with teachers in the classroom to engage with students disconnected from tech career opportunities. Fund employees to volunteer with schools for a half to one day a week, leveraging corporate social responsibility, CSR efforts, employee resource groups, ERGs, and other corporate volunteer program resources. Volunteers learn to teach and teachers learn CS, a win for everyone. See the Microsoft Technology Education and Literacy in Schools, TEALS program, for an example of this in practice, end quote. So I know some people who do TEALS, and I know some people who have a background in CS who then went into education. Like, check out the interview with Grant Smith or GT Roble, who's done TEALS. Both of them are awesome interviews and awesome people. But I also know people who have come from tech, who went into the classroom and were not really good at it at all. So I'm skeptical of the approach. I've seen it work really well, but in general, I'd argue that most CS professionals don't have any idea of how to teach, especially across the grade span. Having taught every grade kindergarten through doctoral student, I can say that you really kind of approach things differently. When I'm supervising dissertation, It's very different than when I'm working with a kindergartner, which is very different than when I'm working with a teenager, etc. So I say this to say that it's not just about the content knowledge, and I really wish people who don't have a background in education kind of understood that more. It's great that you understand this field, that you understand computer science. It doesn't mean you understand how to teach at grade appropriate levels, even if you have a passion for it. You gotta sit in and learn the pedagogy. You gotta sit in and understand kids, etc. But I'll get off of my soapbox. I do wanna say I do value people who want to give back and want to teach, but there's a lot to learn in order to do it well. It's not just, oh, I understand CS, I'll be a great teacher. Maybe. All right, and sub-action 9.4 under this particular action is to work at an industry level to retain CS teachers. That's gonna be hard to do, largely because page 118 mentions that 55% of public school teachers say they are not satisfied with their salary. And again, in CS, you could double, triple, quadruple your pay pretty quickly. All right, this is vocal timbre number 3, as I continue to record before contractors arrive. Action number 10 is to invest in organizations that connect talent from underrepresented groups to tech careers. So how do we do this? This report suggests for sub-action 10.1 to increase support for building technical talent pools for your workforce by promoting systemic reform and funding students from underrepresented groups at institutions of higher education. Now, in the episode with Andre Dowdy that relatively recently came out, Andre mentioned that some school districts are doing this. So this is definitely something that we can do. Even though it's mentioning like Tech Force, school districts could do this. And certainly like nonprofits and for-profit CS organizations. So if you want to learn more about suggestions for that, check out page 120 and 121. And check out the interview with Andre. It was a really good conversation. For sub-action 10.2, this is to establish relationships with institutions that graduate Native American, Black, and Hispanic Latinx students, promote opportunities for paid internships, sprint internships, and apprenticeships with your company. Now, that could certainly apply for a nonprofit and for-profit. I am curious what an internship or a sprint internship and apprenticeship would look like in a school district. I know there are organizations like Teach for America that kind of fast track being able to get into the classroom to teach. And then again, with some of the more recent things going on in politics, making it so that, like, if you're a veteran in Florida, you can start teaching without a degree or background in education, etc. But I'm really curious, like, what it would look like to have more opportunities for people to kind of try out teaching before making a commitment to go and get a degree. So, for example, I started drumming in 8th grade. Then when I was in high school, my private drum instructor asked me to help teach a middle school class. This was like a summer program. Think of it like a camp. And we would introduce middle school kids into percussion. That was my very first exposure to what it was like being an educator. And it was fun. It was exciting. I really enjoyed it. And with that experience, I was like, oh, I can actually teach. This is fun. And so then my senior year, I actually started teaching the drum line that I was a part of and then started teaching private lessons as well. I had like 25 students or so on the weekends. And it solidified for me that, oh, this is something that I really am passionate about because I was spending all weekend teaching and then I was teaching throughout the week in the mornings and sometimes in the evenings for like drumline rehearsals and whatnot. If there are more opportunities to help people get into the field, get their foot in before they commit to a degree, I think that could really help out. Cause I know some people who like hadn't taught and then they went and got a good degree in education and then they realized how difficult it was or it's just different than what they expected. And then they went into like a career in sales or something completely different. So I think that could help prevent some of the dropout or the turnover rate if we have more opportunities for people to teach part-time before they become a full-time teacher. But that's just one thought. Sub-action 10.3 is to fund intermediary programs and organizations to help build pathways to tech for students from underrepresented groups. So I don't know how many school districts would be able to do this, but certainly some CS organizations might be able to help fund pathways for more CS educators. Like hire on a professor at a pre-service teacher education program and make it so like the first year the company pays like 100% of the salary and then like 90% the next year, 80%, something like that. That way the university over time will take on the full salary of that person, but they can get started right away with support from a company. And at the end of the section, they actually have from pages 124 to 126, they've got a bunch of different links for where you can go to learn more about potentially doing this. So I highly recommend checking out all of the links in there if you're interested in it. But then we start on page 127. They talk about venture capitalists and startups. I don't know if that's necessarily relevant to the audience of this podcast, but section 3 on here on page 132 is on sustaining change. And so one of the ways that they recommend doing that is to become a signatory for the ACT report. So if you are a tech organization, you can commit to some things that are on page 135. And then page 136 and beyond is the appendix So it's got the acknowledgements, glossary, summary of the toolkits, and then some endnotes. Now, at the end of these episodes where I unpack some scholarship in relation to computer science education, I like to talk about some lingering questions or thoughts. Now, one of the thoughts that I had is I'm honestly kind of skeptical when I see reports use phrases like, quote, school to tech pathway, end quote, by ensuring, quote, that every student has the fundamental math and science backgrounds to study CS, end quote, from page 16. I'd argue that not all CS requires a background in math or science. A lot of what I've done with like game modding and app development required like no science background. A little bit of physics kind of helped for some things that I was doing, which is where I'm like, okay, I could see some math depending on what you're doing, but most of the programs that I made required like basic addition, maybe some subtraction, maybe some multiplication. So I'm always skeptical of stuff like that. I totally understand you need to be able to use like calculus and other things in CS, or at least you can. And I totally see that there are plenty of connections with science. At least there can be, but I don't think it's a requirement. And I also am very skeptical when it's a school to tech pathway. I don't think everyone needs to go into tech career. Just because people are using something doesn't mean they need to know how it works. Like, I'm sitting in a comfortable chair right now. I don't need to know how to build this chair. But again, I understand the sentiment. It's just when it's like these hyperbolic statements where it's like, everyone needs to do this thing. It's the most important thing ever. I disagree. And I think it can turn people away because people can easily go, I don't know about that. And then it kind of diffuses the argument. So another question I have is when we say a diverse workforce, what does that mean to you? Do you think of someone's race, gender, sexuality, geographic location, socioeconomic status, ethnicity, languages spoken, disability, their age, neurodiversity, veteran status, education level, immigration status, religion, political alignment, marital status, level of experience, dependency status? Are they a dog or cat person, etc.? What about the intersections of all these different identities? What does a diverse class look like in school when the school itself might not be very diverse according to the demographic data that is being collected? And then if one person is the only person who is teaching a subject in a school, like computer science, what can you do to expand the diversity of adults teaching that subject that is being represented within that school? Far too often, I see diversity statements center around race, gender, maybe sexuality, but really none of the other stuff that I mentioned. Like, why are we not talking about disability or veteran status? When it comes to identity and cultures, there's so many more layers. Like, I just listed, I don't know, like a dozen things right there. But that's just the tip of the iceberg of what makes up somebody's culture or cultures or identity. Now, related to that, there's a tendency when some people advocate for diversity to be vague in what's being asked for. So how can we as individuals or as a field clarify goals to strive toward? For example, I've heard some say an organization or a like panel of speakers isn't very diverse. And when I ask what they mean by that, they usually go with what they can see in a picture. And this becomes problematic for many aspects in terms of lack of depth and in terms of misidentifying people. For example, labeling myself as male when I'm very open about being non-binary. But then also it's skimming the surface on what it means to be a human. And it reduces people to like one or two categories, race and gender, when we are far more complex entities than just two demographic categories. They are two very important demographic categories, but they are not the only ones. So if you had a panel of all black women speakers, you might look at that and go, well, that's not very diverse. But then you realize, oh, well, they're diverse in terms of sexuality, they're diverse in terms of veteran status, education level, their political alignment, number of languages spoken, etc. Like, there's so many more nuances that we can look at there than just, oh, it's all black women. But if we start looking at all those different intersections and different layers of identities, it becomes a little bit harder to talk about. It is, I will admit, much easier to just focus on one or two categories rather than a bunch. So I understand why people do it, and I certainly understand why it's important to talk about race and gender, because there are so many things that are systemically set up to be advantageous for some races or genders and disadvantageous for others. So those structural barriers need to be addressed, but there are also structural barriers with all the other demographic categories that I mentioned. Like, think about being a convict who served your time in jail. How difficult is it for you to get a job after that? I mean, if you're considered to be 100% reformed, you paid your dues back to society by serving time, there are so many barriers for you after that, and it's not often discussed. Another question that I have is, when is the purpose of education for getting a job, and when is it not? How do we balance the two across the entire formalized education grade span? Like, when I worked with primary kids, my goal was to just show them how fun learning could be. And then with college students, it was more on career. So something to think about. Should I consider career development in kindergarten? Should I consider it in 12th grade? Maybe, maybe not. I think it depends on the students that you're working for. But this podcast went way too long. I hope you enjoyed this, and I hope you consider taking a look at the ACT report. And you can find a link to this paper at jaredoleary.com, where there's like 160 some odd podcast episodes. There are a bunch of interviews with some really amazing people, so make sure you check those out. And a bunch more Unpacking Scholarship episodes. If you enjoyed this episode, I know it was a little bit different, please consider sharing with a friend or leaving a review. Stay tuned next week for another episode, as long as I can record it before contractors get here. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you're all staying safe and are having a wonderful week.